Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. It doesn't have anything to do with this committee, but my staff was just reviewing the news, and I don't know if any of you know this, but the young girl, Elizabeth Smart, who was kidnapped in Utah 8 months ago, has been found today, and she's alive. And we'll learn more about it, but in this slew of kidnappings of young children, I'm very pleased to make that announcement today.
Thank you. That just presented an impossible segue. So we will go to a public hearing on 2004. We have Representative Canope, Majority Leader Canope, and Representative McPherson here. And then we'll go to our list of witnesses. And you know what, Mark? I don't think you have to give an explanation of what this does. I think everybody in the building has a fairly good idea. So, gentlemen, welcome. Please come up. I've asked Dave Hendricks to sit with us today. We've got the PERS experts here, obviously. Gentlemen, the one thing that, your remarks will be your remarks, but the one issue I would like you to address for us, which I think we need to address in this committee, it was sort of most succinctly stated in a memo or an email that I got this morning from Mark Feldman, who runs the website, PERS information website up at Portland State University, professor up there. And what he says in his comments are, the look back as it appears in the House-approved 2004A continues to draw much attention and confusion. There are two conflicting and opposed points of view about what the House PERS Committee intended when it passed the Draft 11 version of the bill, which is currently known as 2004A. One interpretation holds that the use of the term, quote, refund annuity, option zero in the PERS system is the basis for determining which of the two sets of actuarial tables, 1978 or current at retirement, to use for computing all optional payment forms. The other interpretation, the one codified in the actual language of 2004, is that the look-back is only codified in the look-back is only for the refund annuity option zero, and that the member gets the highest benefit only if option zero is selected. Otherwise, any other option leads to the current at retirement set of actuarial tables. So that was a question that was posed that I think is going to be fairly central to our discussion over here. So I wondered if, in the course of your comments in general, if you would speak to that in particular. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Corcoran, State Representative Tim Canope from Bend, committee members, Representative Hendricks. It's good to see you up there. You add some balance to the committee, and we appreciate that.
I was going to bring up some folks from PERS, but I was told that that violated the protocol of having at least part of the legislative body up here.
Oh, I imagine. Well, Representative McPherson and I worked long and hard on House Bill 2004, and we had, I think, an understanding of the direction that we wanted to head. And I think some of the numbers that came out after the bill had left our committee were not what we had anticipated in that. I think the statement that you read in terms of the confusion is correct, because I think there is some confusion, although at the time that we did it, we were clear about what we were doing, but we believed it had a certain outcome. And apparently that outcome isn't quite as we understood it to be. And I think your -A13s, from my understanding, does accomplish where we were headed. It just does it in a different way.
Okay.
By working on the benefit, essentially applying the look back to the benefit. And when we did the other form, we believed that there would not be a difference, a substantial difference between the different payments. That turns out to be, of course, depending on who you talk to, but we think it turns out to be fairly significant. So I would approve of the change that moves it back to the look back to the benefit of the options. I would encourage you also to take a look at the section of this bill that expedites. And I think there are folks who will come later who will suggest a couple of changes, and I would be in favor of those changes, mainly allowing other people to file in, the employees and the employers and so on, to get in on this as opposed to just the state. And there are a couple other minor modifications that I think the governor would support, and I think probably generally everybody would support. And really, we look forward to your committee going through this again thoroughly and looking at this. It's a complicated issue. Going to the benefit option actually makes it even more complicated in terms of its administration, but it also brings clarity. And I think it brings some certainty to some of the employees that are getting ready to retire and maybe want to choose one of the what I call the downstream options. I'm sure there's a more technical term, but
you might have just canned
that's
one.
Possibly. But nonetheless, options that people would normally use. And so we appreciate the fact that you're willing to take this up again and look at it and try to improve upon House Bill 2004. And we're confident that we'll finally have a work product that will be even better than we had in the House.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions, Representative Knope? Seeing none. Representative McPherson?
Thank you.
Representative Synchronicity, we call him?
I'll wear whatever label you want, Chair Corcoran, members of the committee. I'm here to support House Bill 2004 and to urge your adoption of the Dash 13 amendment. Let me explain how we got to where we did with it. And just by way of background, I would say the one thing I've discovered in my work on the PERS Committee so far is that many of the understandings that I bring to this subject matter based on having worked on pension plans in my law practice over many years is that some of the premises with which you operate don't necessarily hold true when you're dealing with the public employee retirement system of the state. The design of 2004 as it left our committee and then was adopted in the House was based on having the look back, which establishes protection for people at or close to retirement age, apply to the normal benefit form, that's a refund annuity, and not apply to the conversion from that form of annuity to all optional forms of annuity. And that was done in the expectation that the significant effects of updating the mortality tables would apply or relate to that establishment of the normal form benefit. That is, what you're doing is you're converting an account balance, that is the member account, with an equal amount that the employer's provided under the money match formula to a lifetime income. And that's the kind of conversion where the greatest impacts of difference in the mortality table relate, because you're taking a sum certain and you're determining that what lifespan it gets available to cover. Ordinarily, the conversion from one annuity form of benefit to another annuity form of benefit is not a very significant impact, regardless of what a mortality table you're once using, and the effects could go either way, could go up or down. It was only after action on 2004 on the House that we learned that that set of assumptions wasn't quite right. That is, the effect of updating the mortality table could have more of a variation effect for the optional forms of benefit than I was expecting, and therefore I think it's appropriate to do what we had told the members of the House on the House floor this would do, which is that the effect of the look back would be assurance that no member of PERS would get a lower benefit as a result of this conversion at July 1, 2003 than they would have had as of June 30, 2003, based on their then account balance converted under the old table. And that as a result of the Dash 3 amendments, that would be extended to all the optional forms of benefit in addition to the normal form of a refund annuity, and I think that's appropriate protection to provide. I understand that the fiscal analysis that we were presented was based on the understanding that it would apply to all the optional forms of benefits. So this is my understanding is there's no additional fiscal impact by extending it to those optional traditional forms. It really is just making the bill work the way we understood it would work and its principal impacts and dealing with details. And I appreciate you folks batting cleanup for us in our work over on the House side. And I can answer any questions if you have any.
And you concur as well with the. I don't think we've drafted any language yet on looking at the expedited hearing. But would you concur with Representative Knope on the adjustments we may make to that?
I actually haven't heard until just now about that issue about the expedited review, but I would say changes that are designed to assure that all the stakeholders have an option to get this most promptly up to the Supreme Court where these decisions are going to need resolved is the right direction. So if it has that effect, then I think that's just what we need to do.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I may make some additions to what I said, I think it's important to note that in this look-back provision that your amendments, the way to accomplish it is that it's one time only, basically, and it's limited and doesn't create a new contract right, which I think is important, and that also it maintains the integrity of the fiscal that we had on the other side, which Representative McPherson has talked about, and I think it's for those reasons that we can continue to support the concept and the bill and the direction that you're currently headed. So I would applaud your efforts in that regard.
Thank you very much. Any questions of either of these two representatives? Seeing none, thank you so much. You're off the hook. Thanks for coming. Okay. Before we get to the witnesses, I wanted to ask Dave Hendricks to briefly explain the Dash 13 amendments and if you'd like, just give a general overview of the bill itself and then maybe what the Dash 13 amendments do.
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. The HB 2004A proposal that you have before you would provide a long-term structure for implementation of changes in mortality tables and does a one-time look back for purposes of the implementation starting on July 1st of the out-of-date mortality tables to try to do some softening to the effect on people who retire in the next year or two. The Section 2 of the bill is the long-term approach. Section 2 basically says that the Public Employees Retirement Board, as essentially as part of its biennial review of the fiscal situation of the system, will look at the mortality tables. The bill itself talks about actuarial equivalency factor tables, which is the technical term that they use. As a practical matter, my understanding is that consists of mortality tables and the assumed rate for the system, which is currently 8%. So as a practical matter, the things that primarily change there are going to be mortality table changes. There is no look back for future changes in mortality tables. So if in 2005 or 2007 or 2009, there's a change in the mortality tables, those will just be implemented immediately, which will mean that there will be a change to someone who, in the benefit of a person who retires immediately before versus immediately after the implementation. That's to be compared with Section 4, which is the look-back provision. The whole point with the look-back provision is to avoid a scenario where a person retiring the day before the implementation of the mortality tables would get, for instance, $2,000 a month, and if they would retire a month later after implementation of mortality tables, they would get $1,800 or $1,900 a month. Section 4 is what has been referred to commonly as a look-back without interest, and that's not going to be an easy thing to explain, but I'll take my shot at it. The theory on the look back is that there will be two calculations made for people who retire after the tables go into effect on July 1st, 2003. There will be one calculation that will just be the normal calculation based on the mortality tables that are in effect when the person retires. That is, the new mortality tables, the updated mortality tables, looking at all the other circumstances that apply to that individual. Their account balance at that point, years of service at that point, all of the other things that could have an impact on the calculation of that person's benefits. That calculation is made, and then a second calculation is made. And this calculation looks back to June 30th of 2003 and says, okay, how much did the member have in their account at that point? And PERS is going to have to do some special calculations here because normally they don't credit accounts mid-year. They're going to have to go back and come up with some figures to show, A, how much there were in contributions in the account at that point and how much it had earned as of that point. Using that account balance and the old mortality tables, the ones that are currently in effect, they will come up with a second calculation for that individual. The individual who's retiring will then get the higher of whichever of those two calculations produces. The problem that we had from House Bill 2004 on the House side was at which point, which calculations were we talking about when you're talking about calculating that second benefit on June 30th of 2003. The way the House bill was set up, and you have to understand that in PERS there is a basic calculation for the benefit. And without trying to get into any of the details, it's called a refund annuity. And there is an actuarial equivalency factor table. A mortality tables come into play in calculating that refund annuity. They also come into play in subsequent calculations for the member based on which option they pick. I was told, I believe, that more than I thought actually take the refund annuity, something like 20% actually take that option, but that means that four-fifths of the members take something else. And many of those other options involve a subsequent application of actuarial equivalency tables, fact mortality tables. And the simplest one to talk about is if you take one of the options that say, well, I would like to get something for life, and then I'd like to have my spouse have something as well. Well, at that point, what you have done is said you brought in another set of mortality tables because your spouse, who is a different age than you are, is going to have to do calculations to determine what the benefit's going to be for your spouse as well. What the A14 amendments do is basically say that not only will we will not use the old actuarial factors just for that first computation getting to the refund annuity. We will use it for all subsequent places in those calculations for those options, no matter what they are. So the effect will be that the calculation that PERS is making is they will have to say, okay, to the member, which option are you picking? And I don't know if, I presume they'll probably do it for all the different options. They currently tell the members what the result would be under all of the different options. And they would go through the entire calculation to arrive at the numbers. For instance, for you and your spouse, what the numbers would be as of right now, and then they would look back and they would use the old tables for all those same calculations to get to that benefit, to say what would the benefit, for instance, be for me and for my spouse, thus passing along the benefit of the older actuarial equivalency factor tables to that to all the different calculations that are made in arriving at the benefit option amount. The impact for this will be essentially the look back really only applies for purposes of people who retire within the next, I don't know for sure where we're at, a couple of years maybe, probably at most, are the only ones who are going to be impacted by the look back. What it will mean in essence is that on July 1st, the benefit for all members, frankly, will go flat for some period of time. You will not be accruing additional benefits for some period of time, and in effect what you're doing is you're wearing off the impact of the new mortality tables. People who are younger, it won't take very long to wear it off. It may only be a couple of months, or even, you know, if you're just tired, it isn't going to take any time. If you're older, it's going to take longer, because it's going to take longer to wear off the impact of that change when you're so close to retirement age, and if it's a shift of 3 years of life expectancy, it's going to take a while to wear off. It may be a couple of years to wear it off. And during that period, you're not going to lose anything. You won't get less than what you would have gotten under the calculation on June 30th of 2003, but you're not going to get any more either because of the additional service after June 30th, 2003. And so for each member, the period of time it takes to wear that off is going to be different depending on your age, etc. Now, very briefly, look back with interest, look back without interest. This is being called look back without interest because the account balance they're looking at is the account balance on June 30th, 2003. It is not, when they do that calculation, they're not going to look at any additional contributions made to your account after June 30th, 2003. They're not going to look at any additional earnings on your account after June 30th, 2003. You could do it that way. It's one of the other options that were discussed. In essence, when you went to do your retirement, they would use the old mortality tables, but they would use what was your account balance as of the date of retirement, instead of looking back to the account balance on June 30th, 2003. That's the only difference between look back with interest versus look back without interest. Look back with interest, in essence, the way I visualize it anyway, as I just mentioned, that under the bill as it now stands, your benefit goes flat for some period of time. Look back with interest, it isn't so flat. It continues to go up. So it takes longer, basically, to wear off the impact of the look back and reduces the total impact even thereafter. You know, at least for those people who retire, it might extend it out over a longer period of time of the effect of the impact. But that is the only difference between look back with interest and look back without.
So for clarification, David, if a 30-year employee at 55 years old working in ODOT could retire this year, they have his 30 years in it, June. How many years out forward? So his benefit, if he works 5 additional years, would that person still have access to the look back?
If he works for an additional 5 years, probably not. Because if he's 55, as I said, the figures I've seen suggest that even for the ones who are most strongly impacted, we're talking a couple of years maximum to wear off the effect of the mortality tables. And I think the first people are kind of nodding. It may be 2.5. Nobody's quite too sure. It depends on your circumstances. But more likely than not, the look back would not be of any difference to that person.
So it's somewhere in that 0 to 3 year period.
Correct. For those people retiring, it may give them a higher benefit than they would have gotten if the mortality tables had just been put into effect, bam. It basically protects them from getting less. Now they will start getting more their benefit will start growing again at the end of whatever that wear-off period is. It will start to grow again. But, of course, because it hasn't been going on the straight slope it would have been, it's going to be less than what they would have had without the implementation of the new mortality tables.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Miss.
Well, I think I understand what he's talking about. However, okay. I'm convinced I don't. So, I don't know who would do this, but it seems
it seems to me
to be appropriate to graph some of this under several assumptions, or to take several people and say, okay, in this circumstance, assuming this law passed as it's structured, this is how we see it happening. Now, if I understand correctly, what we're really doing is we have an assumption underlying everything we're doing that the actuarial tables that we're currently using are understating the life expectancy of the individual receiving the benefit, and therefore in this look back and this wear down period or whatever we're talking about, we're balancing the system. Is that making sense? So there's an assumption that the benefit earned is higher than it probably should have been based on the actuarial tables that are in use. And then we're instituting a new actuarial tables, and there's just a period of time it takes to phase that in. Now, in saying that the current actuarial tables are too high and that assumption is there, that's not to say that the benefit's not earned or a benefit that, you know, is a contractual obligation. It is. But there's just this phase-in period that is the necessary by virtue of what we're attempting to do. I'd like to see some graphs or some pictures, because I'm a picture kind of guy, that would kind of show me under a couple of sets of...
Maybe some examples.
A couple of examples of maybe pick, you know, five persons randomly and say, what's your situation? And pick a couple of people who are married, have beneficiaries, and let me see how this actually works.
Maybe someone with the high-end use of variable versus someone in fixed, and make some assumptions about income.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We do that, Mr. Delaney?
Chair Corcoran, we...
Come on up. This is the other Irishman in the building, Mr. Boyko.
Actually, I am half Irish, Chair Corcoran. Cork. County.
Did you say it was a quirk?
That too. Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, we have, over the 2 years in which we've studied this question under the direction of our board as well as working with the House Committee, have done quite a few illustrative examples. We did not know that we'd be asked to produce them today. We can produce them very, very quickly. If you so desire, we've looked at all of the factors that make the wear away or the break-even period very carefully. And Mr. Hendricks is correct that under the bill that has come over to you from the House, the turnaround or the break-even point is very, very short for most members, probably a year or less. Only in rare cases might it extend as far as 2 years before people begin, because of continued contributions or continued accumulations of service or continued crediting of earnings to their account. All of those factors drive their benefit up and wash away the effect of the change in policy on July 1st. And as Mr. Hendricks said, when we do the look back, we change two things in the calculation and two things only. We substitute the bright line 6/30/03 account balance that the member has earned to that date with all contributions to that date and all earnings on the contributions to that date. And we put in the old factors. And under the Dash amendment that you're looking at, the old factors would include those that translate that account into the benefit form zero, the refund annuity, which is what the House bill did, as well as all other factors that would be necessary to produce the other benefits. So what the effect is that to make the look back, make those two changes, and then look at the final benefit, whatever option the member so chooses at time of retirement.
And Mr. Boyko, first of all, please state your name for the record.
James Boyko, Executive Director of Public Employees Retirement System, and Steve Delaney, who's our legislative liaison.
Okay. One question. When you say you do that with the Dash 13 amendments, as you understand them, it would require the calculation of those additional options as well as zero option.
That is correct. The point of measurement as to whether or not the member's benefit has gone down when the two changes are made, old factors and the 630 balance to that date, would be done at the final benefit level, not at just the refund annuity, the first step in the calculation.
And I guess just to get one other thing sort of clear on the record, you also understand the Dash 13 amendments to require basically the same calculation that would have been made absent this discussion about new mortality tables and a look back, that you would be handling this the same way you've been handling accounts for the last X years since there's been the last change in PERS?
Chair Corcoran, that would be correct unless this body so instructs us to do it differently, and there are obviously many pieces of PERS legislation just being discussed in the building.
And just personal question, personal information. Who do you think Mr. Johnson is the best person to talk to about the fiscal impact of the look back with interest and without interest?
Chair Corcoran, he did do those estimates for us, has done similar estimates for our board, and did them for the House committee as well. And it is my understanding that the testimony you heard from Representative Canope and Representative McPherson about the fiscal that they adopted for their bill that was done by Mark Johnson, the systems actuary, does in fact comport directly to the amendment that you have before you, so that they connect very well. The only uncertainty that I'm aware of in that estimate is the number of people that might retire between now and July 1st. That's the only obvious source of flux, if you will, in the fiscal.
Okay. Thank you. Now, the additional question that I have for you then is... Oh, I'm sorry.
Ms. Booker, do you have an assumption about how many people can retire in the fiscal?
Yes, there is, and I don't have it off the top of my head, but it's actuary did assume some accelerated sense of retirements. I believe the number might be 7,000 or 8,000 for this year. We are easily on course for that number.
It might be nice to have that on the record, so sometime down in the future we can gauge whether we were accurate or not.
We can produce for the committee, Senator Minnis, both the fiscal that was developed for the House side as well as all the background information for it.
Actually, Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, rather, I believe we have in your packet
the fiscal.
Let's say fiscal.
But is there an assumption about how many people will retire?
Chair Corcoran, Senator Minnis, it happens to be an estimate of 5,100 members retire in the first half of 2003. And as I say, we are very much on track with that. We now have currently booked 4,000 members for retirement.
Okay. Wow. Thank you.
While I have you gentlemen here, a news report from the Bend Bulletin by Eric Flowers states, with regard to the Lipscomb decision, PERS Communication Director David Crosley said the board had taken action already to implement the changes required by the courts. What actions is he referring to?
I am somewhat at a loss, Chair Corcoran, because the board has not officially taken any action with respect to Judge Lipscomb's ruling, and in fact that's being discussed as we speak vis-a-vis issues of stay, appeal, and so on. So if our communications director either said that or was misunderstood, then I have to retract that comment.
Yeah, I don't know if it was, reported wrong or stated wrong. I was just trying to, it raised a couple of eyebrows, as you can well imagine, since people thought they were paying attention to it, and all of a sudden it's reported that they've already implemented the action. So, any other questions of Mr. Boyko? No? Thank you very much, gentlemen. If you'll stand by, that'll be great.
We'll be happy to.
We have Beth Ann Darby and Pat West, OEA, and the firefighters. Welcome.
Thank you.
Oops, excuse me. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Pat West. I'm the president of the Oregon State Firefighters Council, and I'm also representing the PERS Coalition, and with me is Beth Ann Darby of OAA, who is also representing the PERS Coalition. I would like to start out by saying that the coalition is in favor of updating the current mortality tables. We feel that it's necessary to update the tables in a responsible manner that not only fixes an inequity of the system, but also does so without violating the contract rights of the members. The coalition supports the PERS board plan for implementation of mortality tables that includes a look back with interest. It's the fairest and most legally defensible of the options that are under consideration. It would allow members that are near retirement to take a deep breath, continue working, and return with dignity sometime in the future, according to whatever retirement plan they have spent their careers working towards. We also support moving the implementation date of July 1, 2003 from January 1, 2004, because it will save money by lowering the employer rates sooner. If I can, I'd like to address this bill in three different phases. The first one being that of what I call the flat look back, and that is what you've been discussing earlier, dealing with the, it sounds like the A13 amendments.
Well, Mr. West, the A13 amendments just simply expanded the, they don't do the discussion of interest, just expanding the options.
Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair. Basically, House Bill 2004A, as it's written, provides implementation of a look-back provision without interest. The stated purpose of the look-back at all was, rather than immediate implementation, was to stop the rush to the door. But more than 40,000 retirees that are eligible to retire. This bill, as written, will not stop the rush to the door because it applies only to the tables that are calculated using option one, is what I called it in the book. It kind of, you call it option zero, but it's the refund annuity. As stated earlier, most of the members retire under either option two, 2A, 3, or 3A, which are the survivorship benefits of 100% or 50. As the bill is written, they would not be using the old actuarial tables when they compute their retirements. If it's the intention of the legislature that this bill have a true flat look back, it needs to apply to all the options that a retiree can choose when he or she retires. A true flat look back is intended to say a member will receive no less on the day the member retires than he would have received on the day preceding the implementation of the tables. PERS member accounts will in effect be frozen until the benefit calculated by using the new tables exceeds the benefit provided by the old tables. Additionally, if this issue is not corrected immediately, there will be further rush to the door. Members wanting to provide a survivor benefit and also are required by law to provide 60-day notice to their employers of retirement will have to leave by, and this primarily is dealing with educators, will have to have their notice to employers no later than March 31st in order to retire before the implementation of the new tables. So it will continue the rush to the door. It's the PERS Coalition's position that implementation of new tables must include a look back with interest. As I mentioned, this approach mirrors the approach adopted by the PERS Board after much deliberation. This look back with interest must apply to all the options that a member may choose at retirement. I have included with my testimony copies of letters from the PERS Coalition attorney, Greg Hartman, to Chair Knope, dated January 28, 2003. In this letter, Greg describes the coalition's position on contract rights and how those rights relate to the actuarial factors. I would also like to point out that the PERS Board has received legal opinions from the Attorney General's office in executive session that we can only surmise have been similar to those of Mr. Hartman's, because their recommendations, meaning the board, recommendations were to adopt a new mortality table with a look back with interest. I have also included letters from Mr. Hartman to Yvette Eldridge, PERS, dated January 9, 2003, and December 10, 2002, These letters describe the history of the actuarial factors as well as further clarity on the PERS coalition position.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Beth Ann Darby, and I'm with the Oregon Education Association. And I would like to continue the PERS coalition testimony by explaining our support for the PERS board approach and also to talk about some of the issues and potential consequences to members that are beginning to develop as we have had a chance to analyze House Bill 2004A. Unlike the PERS board approach, House Bill 2004A is not based on any recognized legal theory upon which the Supreme Court can rely in its review. After more than a year and a half of consulting with both attorneys from the Department of Justice and outside tax counsel, the PERS board chose an approach for updating the mortality tables that applies the private pension theory of accrued benefits. It makes sense that the PERS board chose an approach consistent with the legal advice that they received. While the accrued benefits theory has not been tested in public pension law, it is a recognized approach for private pension systems. House Bill 2004A provides a level of protection for benefits less than anything currently known in either a public or private sector context. In fact, it uses an approach rejected by the PERS board, despite best attempts by both the PERS board and its staff to utilize an approach providing the greatest relief to employers. Again, the PERS board decision came after extensive legal analysis. In its determination of what ought to be included in the accrued benefit, the PERS board carefully analyzed each component normally included in the calculation of compensation. In its development of House Bill 2004A, the legislature did not discuss the impact of including or excluding anything other than earnings on the account balance, things like the purchases of retirement service credit, sick leave, vacation, or compensatory time. For example, in the case of purchases of retirement service credit, by statute, members may not purchase time earned out of state until either 90 days before or after their effective date of retirement. So while the time was earned prior to the June 30th, 2003 date, members do not have the option of purchasing it and adding it to their account balance and to receive its benefit as part of the look-back feature. The PERS Coalition also believes that by favoring House Bill 2001, the legislature agreed that PERS retirees have a contract right to earnings at the assumed rate. House Bill 2004A denies PERS members the benefit of earnings at the assumed interest rate by making the look-back calculation without using accrued earnings. The PERS Coalition knows that changing the mortality tables is a very important step in making PERS more healthy and stable, but we believe that House Bill 2004A is not the answer. Again, we support implementation of the new mortality tables with a July 2003 implementation date and the look-back with interest approach adopted by the PERS Board. We would also point out that the additional savings garnered from either House Bill 2004A or the look-back without interest fall below what would have been saved had our coalition's multi-segment approach been adopted about 18 months ago when we first proposed it as a legally defensible solution. Much time was lost trying to justify immediate implementation as consistent with legal requirements. In regard to the issue of the clause expediting this matter to the Supreme Court, we believe that the language needs to be amended so that any challenge goes through a circuit court for fact-finding prior to the Supreme Court, rather than in front of a special magistrate. We would prefer to remove the language altogether and have a separate bill expediting all PERS matters together and in the same manner. Thank you very much, and we're happy to answer any questions.
It's my understanding. I don't know. I think I was talking to legislative council that might be technically difficult to do. We just, Senator Menace and I asked for an expedited hearing on another bill, and we were told that we couldn't name the particular bill as something to do with separation of power. Okay, thank you. Any questions from the panel?
Thank you very much.
Seeing none, thank you very much. Bill Gary. He's not here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Gary. I'm an attorney in private practice with the law firm of Harang Long, Gary Rudnick. And I guess one of my current claims to fame is that I'm the attorney, lead attorney representing the petitioning employers in the lawsuit brought against PERS that has been referred to in this building as the Lipscomb case or the Lipscomb decision. Mortality tables was an issue that was addressed in the Lipscomb decision, and House Bill 2004, which would implement updated mortality tables effective June 30th with the look-back that's been discussed, is certainly an improvement over the current practice of the PERS board. As you know, today the board uses outdated mortality tables in calculating the annuity benefit, translating a lump sum of money into a monthly benefit. The tables date to 1978. On average, we are living about 4 years longer today than we were in 1978, and that means that member benefits are higher than they would be if you used current mortality tables. Unless the current mortality tables are used, member benefits will continue to be higher than the statutes provide, and that will correspondingly significantly increase the cost of the system to the taxpayers. That's why House Bill 2004 saves money. But while House Bill 2004 is an improvement over what PERS has been doing for a number of years, it is not an improvement over current law. Current law, the statutes that this body has enacted today, require the Public Employees Retirement Board to use current actuarial factors in calculating the benefit that will be paid to a retiring member. There is no provision in the current law for any kind of a look back. And that means that the simple fact is that PERS is and has for a number of years been paying out more money in benefits to retiring PERS members than the law provides. We know this is the law because the Marion County Circuit Court so ruled in the Lipscomb decision. Judge Lipscomb ordered the Public Employees Retirement Board to implement current mortality tables immediately and fully. And I was interested, Senator Corcoran, in your question to Mr. Voitko in his response, confirming that as of today they've taken no steps to implement Judge Lipscomb's decision. I want to take just a minute to read you an excerpt from Judge Lipscomb's decision because I think it says very clearly the point that I hope to make this afternoon. And this is what he said, and this is back in October when he issued his decision following about a two-week trial. After noting that the actual practice of the board has not been faithful to the legislative mandate and that they were using 1978 mortality tables, quote, despite consistent evidence that members' mortality was gradually improving and that, as a result, retired members were living longer, the retirement benefits of new retirees would need to be reduced in order to maintain, quote, actuarial equivalency, which is the language that appears in the statute today. The judge said, it is the conclusion of this court that the board has acted improperly in refusing to update its mortality tables and has abused its discretion in failing to follow the legislative mandate to maintain actuarial equivalency when determining retirement benefits. None of the justifications and rationalizations offered by the board are sufficient to excuse the board's persistent refusal to implement this part of the statutory scheme, except when it would benefit employee members. And I should point out parenthetically that the rule that the PERS board currently follows says that it will use current actuarial tables if current actuarial tables result in a higher benefit to a member. It will just not use them if it results in a lower benefit. The judge went on to say, neither fear of litigation by employees nor a concern for potential challenge by the Internal Revenue Service is a sufficient basis for ignoring the board's own statutory obligations as established by the legislature. Although the board has just recently adopted a new policy to implement updated actuarial equivalency factors as of January 1, 2004, this new policy offers too little, too late. The old policy clearly does not accord with the statutory mandate, but it would still be continued in effect until December 31st, 2003, under the board's new policy. Moreover, the board has chosen to guarantee that even thereafter, employees' benefits will never dip below the amount which would have obtained under the old mortality policy while it was in effect. That's a reference to the look back that the prior witnesses just described that the PERS board had adopted. Neither proposed practice is permissible under the law. The board has a duty to comply with the statutory mandate immediately and fully. It is our position that the legislature should require, as the court is requiring, that the PERS board implement the new mortality tables immediately and fully. Now, the interveners have attempted to appeal the Lipscomb ruling, and that, of course, is their right, and ultimately a higher court will grade Judge Lipscomb's report card and determine whether he got it right in the opinion. But it seems to us that it doesn't make very much sense until a court has said that there is something wrong with Judge Lipscomb's decision for this body to enact a bill that in effect steps backwards from the law as it has been interpreted by Judge Lipscomb. As a matter of the objective that everybody, I think, has agreed upon, which is to use current mortality factors and to save money by doing so, it doesn't make sense to go less far than Judge Lipscomb says the current law requires the PERS board to go. And as a matter of fairness to my clients, the employers that have challenged the PERS board practices, it seems to me that to deprive them of the benefit of the victory that they earned in the circuit court, assuming that it is affirmed on appeal, by taking going less far than Judge Lipscomb does, also is not what this body should be doing. It seems to me that we should at least have the opportunity to defend the decision of the lower court. Now, in order to do that, we believe that House Bill 2004 should, as House Bill 2003, our employer bill does, and as Governor Kulongoski has proposed, require the implementation of mortality tables effective January 1 of this year. That would be some 5 months after Judge Lipscomb told the PERS board that it was to implement mortality factors immediately and fully. And that also, by the way, addresses the concern about a race to the door to retirement, because it would mean that there would be no window of opportunity for people to retire under benefits, with benefits that are in excess of what the law provides.
Then, Mr. Gary, the race would be to the courthouse.
I think we can agree, Senator Corcoran, that there's going to be a race to the courthouse in any event. Mr. Hartman, my friend and colleague who represents the PERS Coalition, I think will tell you that anything that this body does that reduces member benefits is a breach of contract. Now, we don't agree with that, but that means there's a lawsuit whenever you do anything that is going to produce savings in the system. If the committee is not inclined to completely eliminate the look back, we would ask that you at least write an amendment to the bill that would preserve our ability to argue to the court on appeal what the law provides. In other words, don't moot that portion of our appeal or their appeal of the ruling that we have won. And finally, my ultimate fallback position on this, the effect of the look back in some cases will be that public employees who would retire with a very substantial benefit, significantly higher than the full formula, under current mortality tables, with the benefit of the look-back, will be retiring at with benefits that significantly exceed their salary while employed. And if you're going to have a look-back provision in the bill, then we would suggest that it ought to at least be capped so that it doesn't produce the kind of salt in the wound to the taxpayers of allowing members to retire at benefits in excess of their working salaries. I want to take just a minute to address the subject of contract rights that was addressed by the two witnesses from the PERS Coalition. I will not engage, unless you want me to, in point counterpoint with sure. My
Senator Miss. Mr. Gary, just a couple of things for my reference. What's the statutory reference that exists currently with respect to actuarial?
The Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, ORS 238.300 sub 1 is what I think has been referred to as the zero benefit, and that statute says, and I won't get the exact language, but it says that a member receives an annuity that is the actuarial equivalent of the accumulated contributions and interest credited thereon at the time of retirement.
When was that enacted?
That statute has been around since in various forms since at least when the full formula was adopted in 1981.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, I just want to say I do agree with Mr. Gary that whatever we do, we ought not make moot the points in the Lipscomb case, because I do believe that Judge Lipscomb is right. That's my opinion, being a non-attorney, but I do think he's right. I do think it will be upheld by the Supreme Court eventually.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On the subject of contract rights, what I will provide you the written testimony that I submitted to the House Committee on the issue of contract rights. I think it's sufficient to say here that I disagree with the PERS Coalition's position as to what constitutes a contract right. I do not disagree that contract rights are all over the PERS statutes as an issue, and it's something that we have to take very seriously as we try to craft any kind of amendments to those statutes. But the statute is the contract, and the statute today says that what a member receives, what has been promised to them, is a benefit that is the actuarial equivalent of their accumulated contributions. And to argue that that entitles them by contract to have their benefit calculated using outdated mortality tables, I think, is a stretch of the law upon which the PERS Coalition relies. The last point that I want to address is the subject of judicial review, which is contained in Section 5 of this bill, and there's been discussion of this earlier. And I want to tell the committee that I have had discussions both with the Solicitor General, who will be representing the state on appeal in the PERS litigation, and with Mr. Batchelor, who will be representing the state in its capacity as employer, and with Mr. Hartman, who represents the PERS Coalition interveners, about our mutual interest in making sure that whatever bills come out of the Legislative Assembly and are signed by the governor have a consistent and reasoned provision for judicial review. I think we all agree that it's in our interest to get these issues resolved as quickly as possible. The uncertainty that hangs over current PERS members makes their life very difficult. And so I don't think there's any disagreement as to the desire to have these issues resolved as efficiently as possible. And we have agreed to work together to try to present you with language that could be inserted in each of the bills that you ultimately act upon that would provide a consistent judicial review provision.
Mr. Gary, so then I can expect from you and Mr. Hartman a joint
proposal for an amendment that will deal with that?
Well, I don't want to overpromise. What I can tell you is that we will work toward that. There has been, in the prior witness's testimony, identified an area that is an area of potential disagreement, but we'll identify where we agree and where we disagree. Okay. I believe that we'll be able to come to complete consensus on what judicial review provisions should be included.
The reason I'm asking about that specifically, Mr. Gary, is that I know that there is some time pressure, at least on this particular bill, so we have the one amendment in, which is another question I have for you when you're completed, but I would hope you guys would be able to do that in fairly short order.
We will act on your timetable, Mr. Chair, and I think we can accommodate whatever schedule you want to work on. Let me mention, before you ask me about the Dash 13 amendments, the specific problems that I've identified with the judicial review provision in the current bill. First of all, if the goal here is to have a judicial review provision that expedites it and gets the thing decided quickly, one of the things one has to be careful of is that it allows every challenge to the bill to be brought in the same court. The bill, as it's written, says that challenges arising under the Oregon or United States Constitution go directly to the Supreme Court. That would mean that a challenge based on some other theory would have to be brought in circuit court. And specifically, the arguments that you've heard already that this bill in some way breaches contract rights is not really a constitutional argument. It is an argument that the statutes form a contract and it arises under common law. So that claim, as opposed to an argument that it impairs an obligation of contract, would have to go to circuit court. So you'd end up under the current bill with two different lawsuits in two different courts. Secondly, as the prior witness indicated, there may, particularly in this case, be fact questions that need to be resolved. And the Supreme Court is not a fact-deciding court. It's a law-deciding court. We believe that the proper way to resolve those factual questions, certainly the quickest and easiest way to do it, is to expressly authorize in this bill the Supreme Court to appoint a special master, probably a circuit judge or a retired circuit judge, to conduct a hearing and resolve any factual issues.
That wouldn't constitute double dipping, would it?
For the retired judge?
Couldn't resist.
And Senator, I'll actually answer that question seriously.
I actually have a different view on double dipping. I think double dipping is when you're getting two pensions, not when you're working for one and getting the other. But that's just an aside, and I'm not an attorney, thank God.
I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, that double dipping is a technical legal term in any case. But if they used a retired judge as a special master, it would not constitute double dipping because judges operate under a completely different retirement system. And under the Plan B for judges, I think, which most judges opt to take, they continue to serve as
why did I bring this up,
temporary judges. Problem with asking a lawyer a question, even if it's not meant
you're not
seriously.
An economist.
And I'm not an actuary either. The third problem with the judicial review bill as it's written is, as I think Majority Leader Knope indicated, it does not expressly provide for employer participation in any lawsuit, and that's particularly important to us given the fact that the responsibility for defending any actions taken by the legislature will fall at least primarily upon the Attorney General, and we're adverse to the Attorney General in the Lipscomb case, so we don't necessarily see eye to eye, and we'd like to have the opportunity to be involved. And finally, and this is another area where I will tell you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Hartman and I may not be able to reach agreement, but the bill provides that any challenges must be brought by January 1, 2004. And given the fact that we want to get these matters resolved as quickly as possible, I would urge the committee to consider a little bit narrower window in which these challenges could be brought.
Okay. The only question I had was not whether you were in agreement with the Dash 13s, but whether you understood that the impact of those amendments as explained by Mr. Hendricks and as viewed by the Representative Canope and McPherson and the PERS folks, does what it says it does.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I confess that my understanding of House Bill 2004 until this issue came up was as it would be with the Dash 13 amendments, and I accept the representation that the fiscal impact analysis includes the application of the look back to those other options. Obviously, we oppose the Dash 13 amendments because we oppose the look back, but if you're going to have a look back, it does make sense that it should not depend upon which option an employee chooses.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Dennis?
You may not oppose the look back if we in fact preserved your interests in the Lipscomb decision. In other words, we passed the law, however the Lipscomb decision could prevail.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, as I said, my preference would be to have House Bill 2004 with no look back. If that's not going to happen, preserving our right to argue that Judge Lipscomb got it right would largely satisfy my concern, because like you, I think we will prevail on appeal.
Thank you, Senator Walker.
Yes,
sir.
Thank you.
Actually, do you have any other questions?
No, sir.
Okay.
Thank you,
Senator
Mr. Chair. Mr. Gary, you would agree that we have three branches of government, correct?
Yes.
At least.
Including the lobby?
Well, the reason I ask you that very basic and simple question is because of your comment that I highlighted in my notes, was that going less far than the Judge Lipscomb decision is not appropriate. But the legislature doesn't, we don't always see eye to eye with the courts, and we don't really have to follow the Lipscomb decision if we don't think it's appropriate. Wouldn't you agree?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I did not intend to suggest at all that there was something unlawful, and if I use the term inappropriate, it was ill-advised. I think it's bad policy to go step away and be more generous with PERS benefits than current law provides as it's been interpreted by Judge Lipscomb. But of course this body has, you're amending statutes and you have the absolute authority to amend them as you see fit.
Thank you. I just wanted to make that clear.
Thank you.
I appreciate your testimony.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
To the audience, I want to tell you that this hearing is going to last for 16 more minutes. And we have Tricia Smith, Michelle Deister, Ed Johnson, and Brian DeLashmet yet to testify. Is there anybody else wanting to testify on this? Seeing none. So maybe, Tricia, would you mind having you and Brian come up now and then? Thank you. The reason we're cutting this short is that I'm going to go ask the man in the middle what he thinks about all this.
Can I go with you?
No.
We wouldn't recognize him.
I knew this was a proprietary system.
Yes, he has a vote. Yeah.
You are going to go to the next meeting.
What's the next meeting?
The meeting after this one.
Oh, yeah.
And we're going to do the musical, Music Man. Okay. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I'm OSCA's Government Relations Specialist. OSCA is the fourth largest public sector union in Oregon, representing nearly 20,000 classified and certified education professionals throughout the state. Our members are working in Head Starts, K-12, Community College, and ESD schools and districts all over Oregon, fulfilling the educational promise that we've made to our children by providing them a vast array of teaching and support needs. OSCA is a founding member of the PERS Coalition, and we agree with the testimony that's been provided to you by the coalition. However, the seriousness of this issue and the consequences presented to our members by House Bill 2004A require that we speak directly to you in order for you to understand and the record to reflect our very strong objections to this bill in its current form. For nearly 2 years, OSEA has been involved with other employee groups and employer representatives in PERS effort to find the right way to update mortality tables for existing PERS members. Since the beginning of these discussions, we've supported as appropriate this effort. At the outset, we and other PERS Coalition members supported immediate implementation of the updated mortality tables using what is known as a multi-segment approach. This is the method that we believe in the long run is not only the right way to go, but the most legally defensible approach to take. If PERS had adopted our suggestion then, it would have saved the system millions in future costs. By the way, more than House Bill 2004 would save the system today. Because our members are very concerned about the increase in costs to the system, we remain willing, however, to move a step beyond the multi-segment approach into the more legally risky look-back approach. However, this approach must be implemented in such a way as to provide the guaranteed benefits afforded to our members by the law. OSEA members believe unequivocally that House Bill 2004A violates the contract that PERS members have, guaranteeing them the right to, in the words of the Oregon Supreme Court, an undiminished level of benefits. There is no question that in several rulings, the most recent being Oregon State Police Association versus State of Oregon, our courts have upheld this right. In each of these rulings, the courts have ordered that when this benefit right is breached, members must be made whole. House Bill 2004A violates the contracts of our members in two ways. It does not provide a look back to all members, guaranteeing them that their benefits will not be lower than they were at the effective date of the act. We believe that in addition to the right of our members to an undiminished level of benefits that exists in federal contract law, there is a real danger to the tax-exempt status of the PERS fund if a look-back is not provided to all retiring members. The second way this breaches our contracts of our members is it does not provide the guaranteed accrual of interest in the look-back calculation. I understand the exclusion of most members from the look-back is an unintended error in drafting and that the A13 amendments will correct this problem. We appreciate and support these amendments. The second issue is equally important to address, however, and we are disappointed that the amendments don't correct this fatal flaw. It is well understood that Tier 1 members have a statutory guarantee to the accrual of at least the assumed rate of return, currently 8% on investments. In considering House Bill 2001, the legislature acknowledged this right by capping investments at 8%. This bill received almost unanimous support from all perspectives, a tacit acknowledgement that this guaranteed rate of return cannot be ignored. As the PERS Board struggles to find the right solution to updating mortality tables, they sought the advice of experts in contract law and federal tax law in how far they could go without violating the rights of our members or jeopardizing the tax-exempt status of the PERS fund. The proposed rule finally developed by the Board was a result of that long and exhaustive investigation, and it included interest in the look-back calculation.
Ms. Smith? Just a moment. I want to go back to the first bullet in the two ways that the contract is violated. Is your objection in the first bullet that issue that we're trying to deal with the Dash 13 amendments?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
That's fine. That's all I wanted to know. Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, where was I?
You were we appreciate.
Oh, yeah, we appreciate. We do appreciate the difficulty the PERS Board and the legislature have had in trying to deal with this and other issues in the PERS system. We understand that the serious financial situation we all face brings with it the temptation to do more than the law allows. We urge you, however, to take a longer view of the laws you are attempting to make and recognize that doing it wrong will not work. Only by implementing mortality tables in compliance with existing state and federal law can we finally put this issue to rest. We have heard the argument that this issue will be decided by the courts anyway, so it doesn't matter what the legislature does in House Bill 2004. We disagree. If House Bill 2004A is passed without corrective amendments, we will not be able to put this issue to rest for years as the costs continue to escalate. We are confident the courts will again uphold the rights of our members and require that any impairment be made whole. We will be very disappointed if this legislature decides to put us all through that by ignoring what we believe to be an unequivocal right of our members to their pension benefits. We hope this committee will amend House Bill 2004A with the A13 amendments and further amend the bill to include interest accrual in the look-back calculation. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd answer any questions.
Chair. Senator Minnis.
Mr. Smith, Forest 238.300(1), the current law that I'm assuming is correct, was established in 1981. What part of that is unclear with respect to actuarial tables?
Mr. Chair, Senator Menes, I don't have that statute in front of me, sir, but in my nearly 2 years of working on this issue in the PERS arena and in the legislative arena, I have seen a great many many interpretations of statute that indicate that by diminishing the level of benefits promised to PERS members by implementing tables without a look back or some other protection of the benefits promised to them.
Trish, I'm trying to understand the current law established 22 years ago is, if I understand correctly, the crux of the Lipscomb decision, in which he, in essence, said that the PERS board ignored the statutory law, the directive of the legislature, in implementing updated actuarial tables. And that's the crux of the argument, if I understand correctly. So where is the contract law issue that you're talking about? Where does that exist?
Mr. Chair, Senator Menes, in order not to misspeak, I would ask that you refer to Mr. Hartman's memo that's attached to the PERS coalition.
Well, I've read the memo, but again, I don't think Mr. Hartman's argument makes any sense either. It appears to me that the law was what it was in 1981. It says that you're supposed to have current actuarial tables. That is what it is. Under PGEV Boley, what the Supreme Court will do is look at the plain meaning of the words and the law in existence at the time. And that's, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but that's what they say. And it's pretty plain. And in Lipscomb's decision clearly indicates that the board disregarded the statute. And that's why I think that ultimately Lipscomb will be upheld in the Supreme Court. But I'm trying to figure out where this argument that you're making that contract law is violated. Because that is the contract. I agree with Mr. Gary. That is, in fact, the contract, the law at the time.
Senator Menes, I think probably the best way to handle this would be to wait and bring Mr. Hartman, who is not here today. Let's bring him and
Chairman,
let him...
Mr. Hartman is not here making the statements that Ms. Smith is making.
Granted. I believe, though, that you're getting into an area... I mean, that you're getting into the heart... Well,
there's an assertion, Mr. Chairman, that contract law has been violated, and I would like to know what the assertion is, where the contract law violation is... But they say exist. I don't see it.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator. Sorry.
I too. I agree with Representative or Senator. I'd like to have this witness answer as best possible.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Menes, OSCA believes that because benefits have been promised to PERS members at a certain level, PERS cannot, nor can the legislature, take those benefits away by implementing updated mortality tables on their current accounts. Okay. We believe that it is possible to immediately implement updated mortality tables on benefits yet to be accrued, which is the multi-segment approach that we initially suggested. We do not, however, believe that that can be updated retroactively on existing accounts.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I can follow up. Mm-hmm. So what you're asserting is that the lack of obedience by the PERS board with respect to the existing law and their lack of adherence to the law and their application of old actuarial tables is the promise, and that's the contract?
Mr.
You're saying
Chair,
that's the contract, that because the PERS board did not comply with the law in existence, which Mr. Gary says is a contract, and the board implemented or utilized actuarial tables that were old, that action by the board is the contract, not the law.
Mr. Chair, Senator Menace, I believe the contract is a combination of the statute and the administration of those statutes by the PERS board. And that actuarial table updates can be implemented without contract violation prospectively, but retroactive implementation violates the contract.
Right. I think it raises some very interesting legal questions in the sense that if the PERS board, in fact, did not comply with the law, if they had counsel given to them that they should comply with the law and they disregarded it, who's financially responsible for the result?
I think it gets even deeper than that, Senator Menace, because there's a question of, these attorney general opinions that we have not seen may in fact have contained options. The one of which the PERS board took may have not been, the reasonable one to take, but we don't even have that information. So, mm-hmm. A lot of this is shooting in the dark.
Well, don't misinterpret my questioning. I'm not intending to be hostile. I'm trying to understand exactly where all the questions lie and where the assertions are with respect to contract rights issues. I mean, I understand, at least as a layman, the PG Boley decision and what the court has told me as a chair of the Judiciary Committee, how they interpret statutes. So I'm trying to put these issues to bed in my own brain where the arguments are going to be made. Very interesting. That's why I guess I would agree with Mr. Gary that we not make moot the points in the Lipscomb decision and whatever we do here so that the court ultimately can answer those questions.
Thank you. Mr. DeLashmet, I want to note that for the record that Michelle Deister, who was scheduled to come up next from the League of Cities, has graciously agreed in the interest of time to just submit written testimony, and we will in fact have you folks up when we do the next public hearing on this and work session. So thank you very much for that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I was going to talk very briefly about a different subject, and I'm more than available to come back. I'm in the building all the time. But the issue that I was interested in talking about, if we're talking about updating mortality tables, is an accurate representation of mortality tables for police and fire. And I'm going to supply you with a study, a copy of a study, and then I will email to your staff an attachment so you all can see the study. A study that was done in the state of Washington, recent study done in June of 99, which shows that mortality tables are out of whack on the other direction when it comes to police and fire as much as 9 years. So that while you can argue and the cities and counties can argue the mortality tables are out of whack and that they are taking the brunt of having to pay higher benefits through the system to general membership, I would contend to you that unless there is a very clear look at a differentiation between mortality tables of general service and public safety officers in this state, that in fact public safety officers historically have been getting a shorter amount of money and the study, which you can read for yourself, it's broader than just mortality. It talks about disability and a whole variety of other things. In the state of Washington, talks about 66.4 years mortality in the state of Washington and talks for public safety officers and 75 years for the general service. And so I will be raising that issue. I'll supply you with a study and look forward to further discussions with you.
I think the good senator from East Multnomah would be very interested in that study.
I was just going to say you ought to look at the Eagle Tour Better Than. They're the ones that really get
the next
mood and tattoo.
Did you have a question?
Yeah, I do. This on that issue, as the PERS board looks at mortality tables, is it just they don't separate classes of employees?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, as I understand it, and the PERS folks are here, they do a blended table, and the blended table includes public safety and general service. It also includes male and female, so it's a blended table of all PERS employees. And in the dynamic of that, of course, is that some people get hurt and some people get a benefit. What I'm contending here is there's a pretty substantial difference between the mortality tables that I'm seeing for public safety officers and general service. And I would suggest to you, and I've had conversations with first staff, and we did talk about this briefly at the end of the 2004 hearings on the other side. The chair and the committee over there were open to discussion about this. This information came very late. But the problem that the PERS staff has in making that calculation to this point is there's other people in PNF other than PNF in the state of Oregon, and they have never kept specific or had reporting on the mortality specific to PNF because of that. So they have what they find is their experience across all PERS retirees in the state, but they don't have any study that says this is what our rate for PNF is in this state. And that's the problem. So I would suggest to this committee that we explore this a little farther, and perhaps a solution would be some amendment or addition to this bill that instructs the PERS to go away, collect data on the specifics of a separate mortality table for that, and if it's warranted that there is a substantial variance there, that there be a separate table established for police and fire.
Although the witness looks very familiar, apparently the record doesn't recognize him, so they would like to have his name, please.
Mr. Chair, Brian DeLashment, representing the Oregon Council of Police Association, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, and Pat West gave me his blessing because he had come up before to represent the firefighters.
So we don't have that voice identifier in the system yet.
That's right.
It's been a long time since I haven't done that, Mr. Chair. I apologize.
We're not asking him to tell the truth. Just go identify.
Just identify.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman. Yes, Senator.
Just quickly on the PNF issue, don't PNF folks retire younger and have a higher payout in PERS than general? I mean, isn't that what that's supposed to do?
Well, that's only a function when you're talking about full formula. When it's a function of a money match, which is the dynamic that's driving Tier 1 right now, and to a certain extent Tier 2, then it's a calculation at the end, and you've heard, you know, you're supposed to have an account balance then calculated on years of life remaining, and what they're using is the years of life remaining for a blended table. So, in fact, they do, in fact, get impacted when it's a calculation based upon the account balance using the mortality table. If it, in fact, is a straight calculation on formula, they do not get impacted, is my understanding. Is that they get whatever the formula generates
5 years earlier.
They just start getting it 5 years earlier, but they get that the full formula calculation. So this impact of mortality tables, as I understand it, only impacts the calculation of annuitizing the money match system.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Johnston, I'll give you two choices. You can speak for about 30 seconds, or you can come back to the next hearing.
I'll speak for about 30 seconds, make it as quick as I can, because I don't know if I'll be able to make up for the next hearing. Anyhow, my name is Ed Johnston from Toledo, Oregon. I'm not an expert in retirement or anything like that, but in my opinion, when I grew up, government employees used to get two-thirds of what the private sector made plus 60% retirement. Since the 80s and 90s, the pendulum used to be the private sector up here and the public sector down here. Now it's changed where the public sector is up here and the private sector is down below in our financial structure. And when we got retirements up to 100%, 105%, the general public is sort of frustrated with that because general public is mainly getting Social Security or, if they're lucky, a 40% retirement. And when you got public retirement, government employees making over 105%, they don't feel it's fair out there. And I'm one of those that feel that. And so 60% on the average is what I've talked to people that feel that would be fair. So we need to, you know, save our money on our tax dollars, but let's be realistic to make sure it's a fair balance.
Any questions? Thank you, we're adjourned.